Harry had no clue as to the guy's identity or motivation, but he now knew why the ultra suede jacket had hung so lumpily. If the perp had been packing one grenade, why not two? Or three? After the brief flash of the explosion, the darkness of the stairs was as deep as ever. Harry discarded caution and clambered up the second flight, aware that Connie was coming close behind him. Caution didn't seem prudent under the circumstances. You always had a chance of dodging a bullet, but if the perp was carrying grenades, all the caution in the world wouldn't count when the blast hit. Not that they were accustomed to dealing with grenades. This was a first. He hoped the lunatic had been waiting to hear them die in the explosion and had instead been caught unawares when the grenade boomeranged on him. Any time a cop killed a perp, the paperwork was horrendous. But Harry was willing to sit at a typewriter happily for days, if only the guy in the ultra-suede coat had been transformed into wet wallpaper. The long upstairs corridor was windowless and must have been night black before the explosion, but the grenade had blown one door off its hinges and had torn holes in another. Some daylight filtered through the windows of unseen rooms and into the hallway. Damage from the explosion was extensive. The building was old enough to have lathe and plaster construction instead of drywall, and in places the lathe showed through like brittle bones between ragged gaps in the desiccated flesh of some ancient pharaoh's mummified body. Splintered floorboards had torn loose. They were scattered half the length of the corridor, revealing the subfloor and in some places the charred beams beneath. No flames had sprung up. The snuffing force of the blast had prevented anything from catching fire. The thin haze of smoke from the explosion didn't reduce visibility, except that it stung his eyes and made them water. The perp was not in sight. Harry breathed through his mouth to avoid sneezing. The acrid haze was a bitterness on his tongue. 8 doors opened off the hall, 4 on each side, including the one that had been blown entirely from its hinges. With no more direct communication than a glance, Harry and Connie moved in concert from the top of the stairs, careful not to step in any of the holes in the floor, heading toward the open doorway. They had to inspect the second level quickly. Every window was potentially an escape route, and the building might have back stairs.
Elvis!
The shout came from the doorless room they were approaching. Harry glanced at Connie, and they both hesitated because there was a weirdness about the moment that was unsettling.
Elvis!
Though other people might have been on the second floor before the perp had arrived, somehow Harry knew it was the perp shouting.
The king! The master of Memphis!
They flanked the doorway as they had done at the foot of the stairs. The perp began shouting titles of Presley hits.
Heartbreak Hotel! Blue Suede Shoes! Hound Dog! Money Honey! Jailhouse Rock!
Harry looked at Connie, raised one eyebrow. She shrugged.
Stuck on You! Little Sister! Good Luck Charm!
Harry signaled to Connie that he would go through the door first, staying low, relying on her to lay down a suppressing fire over his head as he crossed the threshold.
Are you lonesome tonight? A mess of blues in the ghetto.
As Harry was about to make his move, a grenade arced out of the room. It bounced on the hall floor between him and Connie, rolled and disappeared into one of the holes made by the first explosion. No time to fish for it under the floorboards. No time to get back to the stairs. If they delayed, the corridor would blow up around them. Contrary to Harry's plan, Connie rushed first through the blasted doorway into the room with the perp, staying low, squeezing off a couple of rounds. He followed her, firing twice over her head, and both of them clattered across the shattered door that had been torn off its hinges and blown down in the first explosion. Boxes, supplies, stacked everywhere. No sign of the perp. They both dropped to the floor, threw themselves down in between piles of boxes. They were still dropping, scrambling, when the hallway went to pieces in a flash and crash behind them. Harry tucked his head under his arm and tried to protect his face. A brief hot wind brought a storm of debris through the doorway, and a lighting fixture on the ceiling dissolved into glass hail. Breathing the fireworks stink again, Harry raised his head. A wicked-looking piece of wooden shrapnel, as big as the blade of a butcher's knife, thicker, almost as sharp, had missed him by 2 inches and embedded itself into a large carton of paper napkins. The thin film of sweat on his face was as cold as ice water. He tipped the expended cartridges from the revolver, fumbled the speed loader from its pouch, and slipped it in, twisted it, dropped it, snapped the cylinder shut.
Return to sender! Suspicious minds! Surrender!
Harry was pierced by a longing for the simple, direct, and comprehensible villains of the Brothers Grimm, like the evil queen who ate the heart of a wild boar, thinking it was really the heart of her stepdaughter, Snow White, whose beauty she envied and whose life she had ordered forfeited. Connie raised her head and glanced at Harry, who was lying beside her. He was covered with dust, chips of wood, and glimmering bits of glass, as she no doubt was herself. She could see that he wasn't getting off on this the way she was. Harry liked being a cop. To him, a cop was a symbol of order and justice. Madness like this pained him because order could only be imposed through violence equal to what the perpetrator dealt out. And real justice for the victims could never be extracted from a perp who was so far gone that he couldn't feel remorse or fear retribution. The geek shouted again.
Long-legged girl! All shook up! Baby, don't get hooked on me!
Connie whispered. Elvis didn't sing, "Baby, don't get hooked on me." Harry blinked. What? That was Mac Davis, for God's sake.
Rockahula, baby. Kentucky rain. Flaming star. I feel so bad.
The geek's voice seemed to be coming from overhead. Cautiously, Connie eased up from the floor, revolver in hand. She peered between the stacked boxes, then over them. At the far end of the room, near the corner, a ceiling trap door was open. A folding ladder extended from it.
A big hunk of love! Kiss me quick! Guitar man!
The walking piece of dog vomit had gone up that ladder. He was shouting at them from the dark attic above. She wanted to get hold of the gook and smash his face in, which was not a measured police response, perhaps, but heartfelt. Harry spotted the ladder when she did, and as she rose to her feet, he stood beside her. She was tense, ready to hit the floor again fast if another grenade dropped out of that overhead trap.
Any way you want me! Poor boy! Running bear!
Hell, that wasn't Elvis either, Connie said, not bothering to whisper any more. Johnny Preston sang Running Bear. What does it matter?
The guy's an asshole,
she said angrily, which was not exactly an answer. But the truth was, she didn't know why it bothered her that this loser couldn't get his Elvis trivia correct.
You're the devil in disguise! Don't cry, Daddy! Do the clam!
Do the clam? Harry said. Connie winced. Yeah, I'm afraid that was Elvis. As sparks squirted from the shorting wires in the damaged light fixture overhead, they crossed the room on opposite sides of a long, waist-high row of boxes closing in on the attic access. From the world beyond the dust-streaked window, faraway sirens wailed, backup and ambulances. Connie hesitated. Now that the geek had gone into the attic, it might be best to flush him out with tear gas, lob up a concussion grenade to stun him senseless, and just wait for reinforcements. But she rejected the cautious course. While it would be safer for her and Harry, it could be riskier for everyone else in downtown Laguna Beach. The attic might not be a dead end. A service door to the roof would give the creep a way out. Evidently, Harry had the same thought. He hesitated a fraction of a second less than she did and started up the ladder first. She didn't object to his leading the way because he was not acting out of some misguided protective urge, not trying to spare the lady cop from danger. She'd come through the previous doorway first, so he led this time. They intuitively shared the risk, which was one thing that made them a good team in spite of their differences. Of course, though her heart was pounding and her gut was clenched, she would have preferred to go first. Crossing a solid bridge was never as satisfying as walking on a high wire. She followed him up the ladder, and he hesitated at the top, only briefly before disappearing into the gloom above. No shot rang out, no explosion shook the building, so Connie went into the attic too. Harry had moved out of the gray light that came up through the trap. He crouched a few feet away beside a naked, dead woman. On second glance, it proved to be a mannequin with permanently staring, dust-coated eyes and an eerily serene smile. She was bald, and her plaster skull was marred by a water stain. The attic was dark, but not impenetrable. Pale daylight sifted through a series of screened ventilation cutouts in the eaves and through larger vein-capped vents in the end walls, revealing cobweb-festooned rafters under a peaked roof. The center offered enough headroom for even a tall man to stand erect, though nearer the wide walls it was necessary to crouch. Shadows loomed everywhere, while piles of storage trunks and crates offered numerous hiding places. A congregation seemed to have gathered in that high place to conduct a secret satanic ceremony. Throughout the long, wide chamber were the partial silhouettes of men and women, sometimes lit from the side, sometimes backlit, more often barely visible, standing or leaning or lying, all silent and motionless. They were mannequins similar to the one on the floor beside Harry. Nevertheless, Connie felt their stares and her skin grew pebbly with goose flesh. One of them actually might be able to see her, one who was not made of plaster, but of blood, flesh, and bone. Time seemed suspended in the high redoubt of the mannequins. The humid air was tainted with dust, the crisp aroma of age-yellowed newspapers, moldering cardboard, and pungent mildew that had sprung up in some dark corner and would perish with the end of the rainy season. The plaster figures watched, breathless. Harry tried to remember what business shared the building with the restaurant, but he couldn't recall to whom the mannequins might belong. From the east end of the long chamber came a frantic hammering, metal on metal. The perp must be pounding on the larger vent in the end wall, trying to break out, willing to risk a drop to the alley, serviceway, or street below. Half a dozen frightened bats erupted from their roosts and swooped back and forth through the long garret seeking safety, but reluctant to trade the gloom for bright daylight. Their small voices were shrill enough to be heard over the rising shriek of the sirens. When they passed close enough, the leathery flap of their wings and an air-cutting whoosh made Harry flinch. He wanted to wait for backup. The perp hammered harder than before. Metal screeched as if giving way. They couldn't wait, didn't dare. Remaining in a crouch, Harry crept between piles of boxes toward the south wall, and Connie slipped away in the opposite direction. They would take the perp in a pincer move. When Harry had gone as far to the south side of the room as the sloping ceiling would allow, he turned toward the east end, where the heavy hammering originated. On all sides, mannequins struck eternal poses. Their smooth, round limbs seemed to absorb and amplify the meager light that passed through the narrow vents in the eaves, where, not clothed by shadows, their hard flesh had a supernatural alabaster glow. The hammering stopped. No clang or pop or final wrenching noise indicated that the vent had been knocked loose. Harry halted, waited. He could hear only the sirens a block away and the squealing of the bats when they swooped near. He inched forward. 20 feet ahead, at the terminus of the musty passageway, dim ash-gray light issued from an unseen source to the left. Probably the big vent on which the perp had been hammering, which meant it was still firmly in place. If the vent had been knocked out of its frame, daylight would have flooded that end of the attic. One by one, the sirens expired down in the street. 6 of them. As Harry crept forward, he saw a pile of severed limbs in one of the shadowy niches in the eaves between 2 rafters, spectrally illuminated. He flinched and almost cried out. Arms cut off at the elbows, hands amputated at the wrists, fingers spread as if reaching for help, pleading, seeking. Even as he gasped in shock, he realized the macabre collection was only a heap of mannequin parts. He proceeded in a duck walk, less than 10 feet from the end of the narrow passageway, acutely aware of the soft but betraying scrape of his shoes on the dusty floorboards. Like the sirens, the agitated bats had fallen silent. A few shouts and the crackling transmissions of police band radios rose from the street outside, but those sounds were distant and unreal, as if they were the voices in a nightmare from which he was just waking or into which he was slipping. Harry paused every couple of feet, listening for whatever revealing noises the perp might be making. But the guy was ghost quiet. When he reached the end of the aisle, about 5 feet from the east wall of the attic, he stopped again. The vent on which the perp had been hammering must be just around the last stack of boxes. Harry held his breath and listened for the breathing of his prey. Nothing. He eased forward, looking around the boxes, past the end of the passageway into the clear area in front of the east wall. The perp was gone. He had not left by the yard-square attic vent. It was damaged, but still in place, emitting a vague draft and thin, uneven lines of daylight that striped the floor where the perp's footprint marred the carpet of dust. Movement at the north end of the attic caught Harry's attention, and his trigger finger tensed. Connie peered around the corner of boxes piled on that side of the garret. Across the wide gap, they stared at each other. The perp had circled behind them. Though Connie was mostly in shadows, Harry knew her well enough to be certain of what she was mouthing silently. Shit, shit, shit. She came out of the northern eaves and crept across the open space at the east end, moving toward Harry. She peered warily into the mouths of other aisles between rows of boxes and mannequins. Harry started toward her, squinting into the gloomy aisles on his side. The garret was so wide, so packed with goods, that it was a maze, and it harbored a monster to rival any in mythology. From elsewhere in the high room came the now familiar voice.
All shook up. I feel so bad. Steamroller blues.
Harry squeezed his eyes shut. He wanted to be somewhere else. Maybe in the kingdom of the 12 dancing princesses with its 12 gorgeous young heirs to the throne, subterranean castles of light, trees with leaves of gold, others with leaves of diamonds, enchanted ballrooms filled with beautiful music. Yeah, that would be all right. It was one of the Grimm brothers' gentler tales. Nobody in it got eaten alive or hacked to death by a troll.
Surrender!
It was Connie's voice this time. Harry opened his eyes and frowned at her. He was afraid she would give away their position. True, he had not been able to pinpoint the perp by listening to him. Sounds bounced around the attic in strange ways, which was a protection for them as well as for the madman. Nevertheless, silence was wiser. The perp shouted again.
A mess of blues! Heartbreak Hotel!
Surrender!
Connie repeated.
Go away, little girl!
Connie grimaced.
That wasn't Elvis, you pea brain. That was Steve Lawrence. Surrender!
Stay away!
Surrender!
Harry blinked sweat out of his eyes and studied Connie with incomprehension. He had never felt less in control of a situation. Something was going down between her and the lunatic, but Harry didn't have a clue as to what it was.
I don't care if the sun don't shine!
Surrender!
Suddenly, Harry remembered that Surrender was the title of a Presley classic.
Stay away!
He thought that might be another Presley song. Connie slipped into one of the aisles out of Harry's sight as she called out,
It's now or never!
What did I say?
Moving into the maze, Connie answered the perp with two Presley titles.
Surrender! I beg of you!
I feel so bad!
After a hesitation, Connie responded.
Tell me why!
Don't ask me why!
A dialogue had been established in Presley song titles. Like some bizarre television quiz show contest with no prizes for correct answers, but plenty of peril for wrong ones. In a crouch, Harry eased into a different aisle from the one that Connie had taken. A spider's web wrapped his face. He pulled it off and crept deeper into the mannequin-guarded shadows. Connie resorted to a previously used title.
Surrender!
Stay away!
Are you lonesome tonight?
After a hesitation, the perp admitted,
Lonely man!
Harry still couldn't get a fix on the voice. Sweat was really pouring off him now. Wispy remnants of the spider web clung to his hair and tickled his brow. His mouth tasted like the bottom of a pestle in Frankenstein's laboratory, and he felt as if he'd stepped out of reality into some drug addict's dark hallucinations.
Let yourself go!
Connie advised.
I feel so bad!
The perp repeated. Harry knew he shouldn't be so disoriented by the peculiar twists this pursuit kept taking. These were the 1990s, after all, an age of unreason if ever there had been, when the bizarre was so common as to establish a new definition of normality. Like the hold-up men who had recently taken to threatening convenience store clerks not with guns but with syringes full of AIDS-tainted blood. Connie called to the perp.
Let me be your teddy bear!
Which seemed, to Harry, an odd turn in the song title conversation. But the perp came right back at her in a voice full of yearning and suspicion.
You don't know me!
Connie needed only a few seconds to find the right follow-up.
Don't you think it's time?
And talk about bizarre, Richard Ramirez, the serial killer known as the Night Stalker, was visited regularly in prison by a stream of attractive young women who found him appealing, exciting, a romantic figure. Or what about that guy in Wisconsin not long ago cooking parts of his victims for dinner, keeping rows of severed heads in his refrigerator, and neighbors said, well, yeah, there had been bad smells coming from his apartment for years, and now and then they heard screams and high-powered electric saws. But the screaming never lasted long, and anyway, the guy seemed so nice, he seemed to care about people. The 1990s. No decade like it.
Too much,
the perp finally said, evidently disbelieving Connie's professed romantic interest.
Poor boy,
she said with apparently genuine sympathy.
Way down!
The perp's voice, now annoyingly whiny, echoed off the cobwebbed rafters as he admitted his lack of self-esteem, a very 90s sort of excuse.
Wear my ring around your neck,
Connie said, romancing him as she prowled through the maze, no doubt intending to blow him away the moment she caught sight of him. The perp didn't reply. Harry kept on the move, too, diligently searching each shadowy niche and byway, but feeling useless. He had never imagined that in the last decade of this strange century he might have to be an expert on rock and roll trivia to be an effective cop. He hated crap like this, but Connie loved it. She embraced the chaos of the times. There was something dark and wild in her. Harry reached an aisle that was perpendicular to his. It was deserted, except for a couple of naked mannequins that had toppled over long ago, one atop the other. Hunkered down, shoulders hunched protectively, Harry moved on.
Wear my ring around your neck,
Connie called out again from somewhere else in the maze. Maybe the perp was hesitating because he thought it was an offer that a guy should make to a gal, not the other way around. Though definitely a 90s man, maybe the bastard still had an old-fashioned sense of gender roles.
Treat me nice,
Connie said. No answer.
Love me tender,
Connie said. The perp still did not respond, and Harry was alarmed that the conversation had become a monologue. The creep might be close to Connie, letting her talk so he could get a better final fix on her. Harry was about to shout a warning when an explosion shook the building. He froze, crossing his arms protectively over his face, but the blast had not occurred in the attic. There had been no flash. From the floor below came cries of agony and terror, confused voices, shouts of anger. Evidently, other cops had entered the lower room where the ladder gave access to the attic, and the perp had heard them. He'd dropped a grenade through the trap door. The gruesome screams conjured an image in Harry's mind, some guy trying to keep his intestines from spilling out of his belly. He knew that he and Connie were in a rare moment of total agreement, experiencing the same dread and fury. For once, he didn't give a damn about the perp's legal rights, excessive use of force, or the proper way of doing things. He just wanted the bastard dead. Above the screams, Connie tried to reestablish the dialogue.
Love me tender. Tell me why,
the perp demanded, still doubting her sincerity.
My baby left me,
Connie said. The screams were subsiding on the floor below. Either the injured man was dying or others were moving him out of the room where the grenade had detonated.
Any way you want me,
Connie said. The perp was silent for a moment. Then his voice echoed through the room, infuriatingly directionless.
I feel so bad.
I'm yours,
Connie said. Harry couldn't get over the speed with which she thought of the appropriate titles.
Lonely man,
the perp said, and indeed he sounded miserable.
I got a thing about you, baby,
Connie said. She's a genius, Harry thought admiringly, and seriously obsessed with Presley. Counting on the perp being pretty much distracted by Connie's weird seduction, Harry risked showing himself. Because he was directly under the peak of the roof, he rose slowly to his full height and surveyed the garret on all sides. Some piles of boxes were shoulder high, but many others were only a few inches higher than Harry's waist. A lot of human forms stared back from the shadows tucked in among the boxes and even sitting on them. But all of them must have been mannequins, because none moved or shot at him.
Lonely man. All shook up,
the perp said despairingly.
There's always me.
Please don't stop loving me.
Can't help falling in love,
Connie said. Standing, Harry had a slightly better sense of the direction from which the voices arose. Both Connie and the perp were ahead of him, but at first he couldn't discern if they were close to each other. He could not see over the boxes into any of the other avenues of the maze.
Don't be cruel,
the perp pleaded.
Love me,
Connie urged.
I need your love tonight.
They were at the west end of the attic, the south side, and they were close to each other.
Stuck on you,
Connie insisted.
Don't be cruel.
Harry sensed an escalation in the intensity of the dialogue, subtly conveyed in the gunman's tone, in the speed of responses, and in his repetition of the same title.
I need your love tonight,
said Connie.
Don't be cruel.
Harry stopped putting caution first. He hurried toward the voices into an area more densely populated by mannequins, groups clustered in niches between boxes, pale shoulders, graceful arms, hands pointing or raised as if in greeting. Painted eyes sightless in the gloom, painted lips eternally parted in half-formed smiles and greetings never vocalized in passionless, erotic sighs. More spiders lived there, too, evidenced by webs that tangled in his hair and stuck to his clothes. As he moved, he wiped the gossamer off his face. Wispy rags of it dissolved on his tongue and lips, and his mouth flooded with saliva as nausea gripped him. He choked down his gorge and expelled a wad of spittle and spider stuff.
It's now or never,
Connie promised from somewhere nearby. The familiar answering three words had become less of a plea than a warning.
Don't be cruel.
Harry had the feeling the guy wasn't being lulled at all, but was ticking toward a new explosion. He proceeded another few feet and stopped, turning his head from side to side, listening intently, afraid he would miss something because the booming of his own heart was so loud in his ears.
I'm yours. Puppet on a string. Let yourself go,
Connie urged, voice falling to a stage whisper to foster a false sense of intimacy with her prey. Although Harry respected Connie's skills and instincts, he was afraid that her eagerness to succor the perp was distracting her from the realization that the perp might not be responding out of his confusion and longing, but out of a similar desire to succor her.
Playing for keeps. One broken heart for sale,
Connie said. She sounded as if she was right on top of Harry, in the next aisle, surely no farther than two aisles away and parallel with him.
Ain't that loving you, baby? Crying in the chapel,
whispered Connie. Connie's whisper had grown more fierce than seductive, as if she was also aware that something had gone wrong with the dialogue. Harry tensed, waiting for the perp's response, squinting into the gloom ahead, then turning to look back the way he had come when he imagined the smiling, moon-faced killer stealing up behind him. The attic seemed to be not merely silent, but the source of all silence, as the sun was the source of light. The unseen spiders moved with perfect stealth through all the dark corners of that high room, and millions of dust motes drifted soundlessly as planets and asteroids in the airless void of space. And on both sides of Harry, gathering of mannequins stared without seeing, listened without hearing, posed without knowing. Forced between clenched teeth, hard as a threat, Connie's whisper had ceased to be an invitation, had become a challenge, and song titles no longer constituted her entire rap.
Any way you want me, you toad. Come on. Come to Mama. Let yourself go, dirtbag.
No reply. The attic was silent, but also eerily still, filled with less motion than a dead man's mind. Harry had the strange feeling that he was becoming one of the mannequins that stood around him, his flesh transformed into plaster, his bones into steel rods, sinews and tendons changing into bundles of wire. He let only his eyes move, and his gaze slid across the inanimate citizens of the garret. Painted eyes, pale breasts with permanently erect nipples, round thighs, tight buttocks curving away into darkness, hairless torsos, men and women, bald heads or matted wigs caked with dust. painted lips, puckered as if to plant a kiss or in a playful pout, or parted slightly as if in erotic surprise at the electricity of a lover's touch. Others formed into shy smiles, some coy, some with a broader curve, the dull gleam of teeth, here a more thoughtful smile and there a full and perpetual laugh. No. Wrong. The dull gleam of teeth. Mannequin teeth don't gleam. No saliva on mannequin teeth. Which one? There. There in the back of the niche, behind four true mannequins, one clever mime peering out between bald and bewigged heads, almost lost in shadows, but moist eyes glistening in the dimness, no more than 6 feet away, face to face, the smile opening wider as Harry watched, wider but as humorless as a wound, the weak chin, the moon face, and one more song title so soft as to be barely audible, Blue Moon. Harry taking in all of this in an instant, even as he was bringing up the muzzle of his revolver and squeezing the trigger. The perp opened fire with his Browning 9mm maybe a fraction of a second before Harry did, and the attic was filled with the crashes and echoes of shots. He saw the flash of the pistol's muzzle, which seemed to be directly in front of his chest. Oh, God, please, and he emptied his revolver faster than seemed possible, all in a blink, if he dared to blink, the weapon bucking so hard that it seemed likely to fly out of his grip. Something hit him hard in the gut, and he knew he'd been shot, though he had no pain yet, just a sharp pressure and a flare of heat. And before the pain could follow, he was knocked backward, mannequins toppling into him, driving him against the wall of the aisle. The stacked boxes rocked, and some were dislodged into the next branch of the maze. Harry was carried to the floor in a clatter of plaster limbs and hard, pale bodies, trapped under them, gasping for breath, trying to shout for help, able to make no sound louder than a wheeze. He smelled the distinct metallic odor of blood. Someone snapped on the attic lights, a long string of small bulbs hanging just under the peak of the roof, but that improved visibility only for a second or two, just long enough for Harry to see that the perp was part of the weight that held him on the floor. The moon face peered down from the top of the heap between the naked interlocking limbs and past the hairless skulls of the mannequins, his eyes now as sightless as theirs. His smile was gone. His lips were painted, but with blood. Although Harry knew that the lights were not actually going out, it seemed as though they were on a dimmer being cycled off. He tried to call out for help, but still could only wheeze. His gaze shifted from the moon face toward the fading light bulbs overhead. The last thing he saw was a rafter streaming with tattered cobwebs, cobwebs that fluttered like the flags of long-lost nations. Then he slipped into darkness, as deep as a dead man's dream. Out of the west-northwest, ominous clouds rolled like silent battalions of war machines driven by a high-altitude wind. Though the day was still calm and pleasantly warm at ground level, the blue sky steadily vanished behind those thunderheads. Janet Marco parked her broken-down Dodge at one end of the alleyway. With her 5-year-old son, Danny, and the stray dog that had recently attached itself to them, she walked along that narrow back street examining the contents of one garbage can after another, seeking survival in the discards of others. The east side of the alley was flanked by a deep but narrow ravine filled with immense eucalyptus trees and a tangle of dried brush, while the west side was defined by a series of 2- and 3-car garages separated by wrought iron and painted wood gates. Beyond some of the gates, Janet glimpsed small patios and cobbled courtyards shaded by palms, magnolias, ficuses, and Australian tree ferns that flourished in the ocean air. The houses all faced the Pacific over the roofs of other houses on lower tiers of the Laguna Hills, so they were mostly 3 stories tall, vertical piles of stone and stucco and weathered cedar shingles designed to make maximum use of the expensive real estate. Though the neighborhood was affluent, the rewards of scavenging were pretty much the same there as anywhere else. Aluminum cans that could be returned to a recycling center for pennies, and redeemable bottles. However, once in a while she found a treasure. Bags of clothes that were out of style but looked unworn, broken appliances that would fetch a couple of dollars from a second-hand shop if they needed only minor repairs, unwanted costume jewelry or books and old-fashioned phonograph records that could be resold to specialty shops for collectors. Danny toted a plastic garbage bag into which Janet dropped the aluminum cans. She carried another bag to hold the bottles. As they progressed along the alleyway under a rapidly darkening sky, Janet repeatedly glanced back at the Dodge. She worried about the car and tried never to get more than 2 blocks from it, keeping it in sight as much as possible. The car was not only a means of conveyance, it was their shelter from the sun and the rain and a place to store their meager belongings. It was home. She lived in dread of a mechanical breakdown severe enough to be irreparable, or irreparable within their means, which was the same thing. But she was mostly afraid of theft, because with the car gone, they would have no roof over their heads, no safe place to sleep. She knew that no one was likely to steal such a rolling wreck. The thief's desperation would have to exceed Janet's own, and she could not conceive of anyone more desperate than she was. From a large brown plastic trash can, she extracted half a dozen aluminum cans that someone had already flattened and that ought to have been separated for recycling. She put them in Danny's garbage bag. The boy watched solemnly. He said nothing. He was a quiet child. His father had intimidated him into being the next thing to a mute, and in the year since Janet had cut that domineering bastard out of their lives, Danny had become only slightly less withdrawn. Janet glanced back at the car. Still there. Cloud shadows fell over the alleyway, and a soft, salt-scented breeze arose. From far out over the sea came a low peal of thunder. She hurried to the next can, and Danny followed her. The dog, which Danny had named Woofer, sniffed at the trash containers, padded to a nearby gate, and poked his snout between the iron bars. His tail wagged continuously. He was a friendly mutt, reasonably well-behaved, the size of a golden retriever, with a black and brown coat and a cute face. But Janet tolerated the cost of feeding him only because he had drawn so many smiles from the boy in the past few days. Until Woofer came along, she had almost forgotten what Danny's smile was like. Again, she glanced at the battered Dodge. It was all right. She looked toward the other end of the alley, and then toward the brush-choked ravine and peeling trunks of the huge eucalyptuses across the way. She was not afraid of just car thieves, and not merely of residents who might object to her rummaging through their garbage. She was also afraid of the cop who had been harassing her lately. No, not a cop. Something that pretended to be a cop. Those strange eyes, the kind and freckled face that could change so swiftly into a creature out of a nightmare. Janet Marco had one religion, fear. She had been born into that cruel faith, without being aware of it, as full of wonder and the capacity for delight as any child. But her parents were alcoholics, and their sacrament of distilled spirits revealed in them an unholy rage and a capacity for sadism. They vigorously instructed her in the doctrines and dogmas of the cult of fear. She learned of only one God, which was neither a specific person nor a force. To her, God was merely power, and whoever wielded it was automatically elevated to the status of deity. That she had fallen under the thrall of a wife-beater and control freak like Vince Marco as soon as she was old enough to escape her parents was no surprise. But then she was devoted to victimhood, had a need to be oppressed. Vince was lazy, shiftless, a drunkard, a gambler, a womanizer, but he was highly skilled and energetic when it came to crushing the spirit of a wife. For 8 years they had moved around the West, never staying longer than 6 months in any town, while Vince made a subsistence living, although not always an honest one. He didn't want Janet to develop friendships. If he remained the only consistent presence in her life, he had total control. There was no one to advise and encourage her to rebel. As long as she was utterly subservient and wore her fear for him to see, the beatings and torments were less severe than when she was more stoical and denied him the pleasure of her anguish. The God of fear appreciated visible expressions of his disciples' devotion every bit as much as did the Christian God of love. Perversely, fear became her refuge and her only defense against even greater savageries. And so she might have continued until she was no better than a shivering, terrorized animal cowering in its burrow. But Danny came along to save her. After the baby was born, she began to fear for him as much as for herself. What would happen to Danny if Vince went too far some night and, in an alcoholic frenzy, beat her to death? How would Danny cope alone, so small, so helpless? In time, she feared harm to Danny more than to herself, which should have added to her burden, but which was strangely liberating. Vince didn't realize it, but he was no longer the only consistent presence in her life. Her child, by his very existence, was an argument for rebellion and a source of courage. She still might never have become courageous enough to throw off her yoke if Vince had not raised his hand to the boy. One night, a year ago, in a dilapidated rental house with a desert brown lawn on the outskirts of Tucson, Vince had come home reeking of beer and sweat and some other woman's perfume, and had beaten Janet for sport. Danny was 4 then, too small to protect his mother, but old enough to feel that he ought to defend her. When he appeared in his pajamas and tried to intervene, his father slapped him repeatedly, viciously, knocking him down and kicked at him until the boy scrambled out of the house into the front yard, weeping and terrified. Janet had endured the beating, but later, when both her husband and her boy were asleep, she'd gone to the kitchen and taken a knife from a wall rack near the stove. Utterly fearless for the first, and perhaps last, time in her life, she returned to the bedroom and stabbed Vince repeatedly in the throat, neck, chest, and stomach. He woke as the first wound was inflicted, tried to scream, but only gurgled as his mouth filled with blood. He resisted, briefly and ineffectually. After checking on Danny in the next room to be sure he had not awakened, Janet wrapped Vince's body in the blood-stained bedsheets. She tied the shroud in place at his ankles and neck with clothesline, dragged him through the house, out of the kitchen door, and across the backyard. The high moon grew alternately dim and bright as clouds like galleons sailed eastward across the sky, but Janet was not concerned about being seen. The shacks along that stretch of the state route were widely spaced, and no lights glowed in either of the 2 nearest homes. Driven by the grim understanding that the police could take her from Danny as surely as Vince might have done, she hauled the corpse to the end of the property and out into the night desert, which stretched unpopulated to the far mountains. She struggled between mesquite shrubs and still-rooted tumbleweeds, across soft sand in some places and hard tables of shale in others. When the cold face of the moon shone, it revealed a hostile landscape of stark shadows and sharp alabaster shapes. In one of the deeper shadows, an arroyo carved by centuries of flash floods, Janet abandoned the corpse. She stripped the sheets off the body and buried those, but she didn't dig a grave for the cadaver itself because she hoped that night scavengers and vultures would pick the bones clean quicker if it was left exposed. Once the denizens of the desert had chewed and pecked the soft pads of Vince's fingers, once the sun and the carrion eaters got done with him, his identity might be deduced only by dental records. Since Vince had rarely seen a dentist and never the same one twice, there were no records for the police to consult. With luck, the corpse would go undiscovered until the next rainy season, when the withered remains would be washed miles and miles away, tumbled and broken and mixed up with piles of other refuse, until they had essentially disappeared. That night, Janet packed what little they owned and drove away in the old Dodge with Danny. She was not even sure where she was going until she had crossed the state line and driven all the way to Orange County. That had to be her final destination because she couldn't afford to spend more money on gasoline just to get farther away from the dead man in the desert. No one back in Tucson would wonder what had happened to Vince. He was a shiftless drifter, after all. Cutting loose and moving on was a way of life to him. But Janet was deathly afraid to apply for welfare or any form of assistance. They might ask her where her husband was, and she didn't trust her ability to lie convincingly. Besides, in spite of carrion eaters and the dehydrating ferocity of the Arizona sun, maybe someone had stumbled across Vince's body before it had become unidentifiable. If his widow and son surfaced in California, seeking government aid, perhaps connections would be made deep in a computer, prompting an alert social worker to call the cops. Considering her tendency to succumb to anyone who exerted authority over her, a deeply ingrained trait that had been only slightly ameliorated by the murder of her husband, Janet had little chance of undergoing police scrutiny without incriminating herself. Then they would take Danny away from her. She could not allow that. Would not. On the streets, homeless but for the rusted and rattling Dodge, Janet Marco discovered that she had a talent for survival. She was not stupid. She had just never before had the freedom to exercise her wits. From a society whose refuse could feed a significant portion of the third world, she clawed a degree of precarious security, feeding herself and her son with recourse to a charity kitchen for the fewest possible meals. She learned that fear, in which she had long been steeped, did not have to immobilize her. It could also motivate.